From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as Detroit tries to land a big new Fiat Chrysler plant, a lot of folks remember the development promises made and broken by the Illiches for their hockey arena.
I think it creates the skepticism, and people say, how do we know you're going to do what you say you're going to do?
Now that pot is legal, what Michigan could learn from California in clearing away old pot convictions.
A lot of the advocacy came from groups trying to get the word out saying, hey, you know, if you have this conviction on your record, you can go and petition and get it potentially cleared or reduced.
Building ties in Michigan through roots music.
If you go underneath the ground, under every living tree, and you find what connects those branches. That's why roots music seems to be the perfect way to talk about the connections.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, Detroit City Council's Planning and Economic Development Committee is scheduled to consider the incentives Detroit is offering to Fiat Chrysler to build a new Jeep assembly plant on the east side of the city. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes notes the backdrop for all of this, the history of what Detroit gave the Illich family to help build their Little Caesars Arena, a history with a lot of failed promises made by the billionaire family. Daniel, certainly there's eagerness at City Hall to land Detroit's first auto assembly plant in, what, some 30 years. This is a big get.
It's a huge get, and it's also a get of building the hottest SUV in the world right now. It's huge for Detroit, and we've seen, like in GM and Lordstown, how valuable an auto plant is to a community. And there's no question that getting a plant like this in Detroit to build Grand Cherokees of all shapes and sizes is huge.
I mean, we're talking, what, $2.5 billion investment, and you're talking about 5,000-some jobs.
Almost 5,000 jobs, that's right.
Yes.
And Detroiters will get second crack at those jobs. And what I mean by that, the first in line will be any existing FCA, UAW employees who can bid on those jobs. And after that, a first in line will be Detroiters.
All right. So to get this plant build out that FCA wants, what has to happen?
Well, the city had to assemble about 200 acres of land adjacent to the city, some of which was owned by other property owners, including the Maroon family.
Mm.
So they cut a deal with the Maroon family and essentially did some land swapping. And so people in Southwest Detroit are now upset that Matty Maroon has got more land in their neighborhood and they weren't consulted. So you've got that going on. But I think in both cases, with both the Illiches that you mentioned at the top and the Maroons, they were here very early in Detroit. They've been landowners for a very long time through some very lean times. And there are some really bad feelings, I think, within the community, even within the business community, about the way that those folks take care of that land and what they haven't done with it or the uses that they have used for.
And let's just kind of revisit, just to refresh memories of everybody around the state listening to us talk.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke with your colleague Nolan Finley about his recent editorial holding the Illiches to task for a whole heap of failed promises.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. With District Detroit is a development that is anchored by Little Caesars Arena. And it gets about between $350 and $400 million in public subsidies for that project. And as part of that, what they were supposed to be doing is doing a lot of residential and commercial development around the arena. Instead, what you see, and you don't need an urban planning degree to see this, is a lot of surface parking lots with some nice flowers and some nice manicured beds and things like that. But nevertheless, surface parking lots in the core downtown. And the sense is that the Illiches have not delivered on a lot of their promises. They've made some excuses. And frankly, as people have been writing about this issue, they have been stonily silent. There was an HBO special that caused them to make a statement and push back a little bit. They pushed back on that, and that's been about it.
That's been about it. And we should note, of all of those parking lots, the city of Detroit doesn't get a penny.
That's right. And the other thing is that the value of that land that they could capture additional taxes off of is not being invested in. So that land as a parking lot is less valuable than it would be as a, let's say, a building with commercial retail on the ground floor and maybe residents above it.
Okay, so what lessons should the city, which of course is eager to land Detroit's first assembly plant in some 30 years, as they sit down and work with all of these landowners, including the Maroons, giving FCA what it wants, what lessons does the city need to take from what happened with the Illiches and District Detroit?
I think they've already learned the lessons. In some recent deals that they've done, they put in requirements for hiring a certain amount of Detroiters to the extent possible. They've created a mechanism that tracks city income taxes, though. So every year, the FCA will have to say how many of the people that are on their payroll pay city income taxes and live in the city, that is, pay resident rates, not non-resident rates, as there are two different rates in Detroit. So they want to be able to hold their feet to the fire, to put it bluntly, and they will fine them if they don't meet those targets.
And what does this actually serve to as a benchmark, doesn't it, for future, when you think of the development that's going on, names like Ford, names like Gilbert? How does this affect future plans going forward?
Well, I think one of the points I made in the piece, and I've made it several times, is I think we have a business community now that is aggressive and opportunistic in Detroit, and they know that keeping your promises is good business in Detroit. And so you see companies like Ford, like FCA, like Dan Gilbert, like DTE Energy, and others who are doing what they say they're going to do. And I think the lesson is the people who were here first, the Maroons, the Illiches, they have a record of not doing what they say they're going to do. And I think that's the real distinction. Now, the city is putting in some expectations and putting them in contracts to make sure that things get done the way they promise they will be done, community benefits agreements and things like that. But I don't think there's any question that the ethos of the business leadership today in general is do what you say you're going to do.
And as Nolan pointed out as we talked with him, when Mayor Duggan is asked about District Detroit and the failed promises, he just says, I'm focusing on the neighborhood. So it seems City Hall realizes that that ship sailed.
As they say in Germany, yein. yes and no. I mean, I think, look, they will also say, this deal wasn't cut by me, by Mayor Duggan. This was cut by the emergency manager, which I think is a bit of a cop-out. It's still their problem. I will also say that I get the distinct impression in talking to some people who are in a position to know that they're going to turn their attention to this Illich situation and try to turn up the heat in certain ways, because it is a problem, and it creates, and I think this is the bigger issue, it creates problems for investment going forward, because I think it creates the skepticism and people say, how do we know you're going to do what you say you're going to do? And I think that's the real issue and the thing they need to answer.
And certainly the backdrop of the meeting on Thursday as they proceed forward with FCA.
Yeah, and I think their sense is that they will get this thing through, but they certainly are having to do a lot of explaining and answering a lot of questions.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wayne State University has itself a problem. Few students who enter the university earn a degree. Until recently, only about a quarter of Wayne State freshmen could be assured of a degree within 6 years, the worst rate in America. Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman reports on how that number has since improved.
If all goes well, India Pleasant will graduate 3 years from now from Wayne State University in Detroit with her bachelor's degree in criminal justice. But like a lot of non-traditional students, that's just one of many, many things on her plate right now.
I wake up around like 5 o'clock a.m. I get my little brother ready for school. I take him to school every morning, start studying since I'm up so early. And I go to my classes because I have early classes. And usually my classes end about 1-ish or 2:15-ish. Then I come to Southfield to go to my old high school where I coach step team, which is step practice usually every day. After I do that, I leave. Most days, I go straight to work at Masonic Temple, Fox Theater. I go shopping for my mom often because she works and she can't do it herself.
And on top of all that, she's a full-time student with 15 credit hours. She has to help her brother with his homework, sometimes cook dinner, and she has to do her own homework and get ready for class the next day. For the longest time, students like India weren't likely to graduate from Wayne State. In 2011, only 9% of African American students were graduating in 6 years. For students whose parents didn't go to college, only 18% were making it. All over the country, there are huge discrepancies in completion rates, especially when you look at race and family income. So many students, like India, are juggling outside obligations.
They're not just necessarily students getting up, coming from the residence hall, work, going to class, you know, finding time for homework, and that's all they do.
That's Alicia Ortez, an advisor on campus. She's one of many that Wayne State has hired in a huge push to raise its graduation rates. Unlike advisors of a different era, she sees her job as a lot more than just talking to students about tuition and financial aid. When students are struggling in class, her big question is,
well, why? Let's try to get that person connected so that we can figure out what's going on so that they can do their best.
The advisors are part of a broad strategy at Wayne State. There are scholarships. India got one. There are new study requirements and a summer bridge program that helps students stay on track. And all of this is beginning to pay off. Last year, the six-year completion rate for all students was 47%. And for first-generation students, it's up to 37%. And now, 22% of African Americans at Wayne get their degree. Wayne State has made progress, but not enough.
We at Wayne State have still large educational disparities around race, ethnicity, around income status, around first generation.
This is Monica Brockmeyer. She's the Senior Associate Provost for Student Success at Wayne State. She says they set a goal of getting 50% of their students to graduate from Wayne in 6 years.
We set that goal because at the time it seemed like a really kind of even unimaginably attainable goal.
But now that they're close to 50?
I think we're going to hit it this year, early in 2019, or be very, very close.
I asked India how she manages her crazy schedule and still keeps her grades up.
I go to church. I tell myself as long as I can make it Sunday, I give myself little treats. I say, oh, girl, you're going to get a cookie if you make it through the day.
So does she expect to walk across the graduation stage in 2022?
Yes, you can expect me to walk across the stage with a cap and a gown and a Wayne State button that the provost gave me.
That was Michigan radio reporter Bryce Huffman. Coming up.
Robert and I grew up about 25 minutes apart from each other in completely different worlds.
Common Chords, a roots music duo using art and their personal experiences to preach the gospel of our collective humanity. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
You're going to reap just what you sow. If you've been a gambler,
if you've been a gambler,
better quit your gambling.
Better quit your gambling.
If you've been a gambler,
if you've been a gambler,
better quit your gambling.
Better quit your gambling.
If you've been a gambler,
if you've been a gambler,
well, you better quit your gambling.
Better quit your gambling.
You're gonna reap just what you sow. Sowing on the mountain,
sowing on the mountain,
reaping in the valley.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They met while doing back-to-back music shows on public radio in Detroit, and that chance scheduling blossomed into a friendship going strong after more than three decades, a friendship grounded in their love of acoustic roots music.
It was a big day,
oh,
day in Dallas.
Oh,
oh, I wish I was there.
Oh,
spend my last $100 on that iron gray mare. See her travel all day long, long, long. See her travel all day long.
The Reverend Robert Jones and Matt Watroba have spent these decades crisscrossing Michigan and the country, bringing their roots music to audiences of all ages. Now they're taking this work to a new level, forming a nonprofit called Common Chords, aiming to connect Michigan's diverse communities through music. Robert Jones, Matt Watroba, it is such a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
I love what you do here, Cynthia. Thank you so much for having us on.
Well, I got to say, it's a personal pleasure for me because back in the early 90s, I would run my Saturday errands starting Saturday morning, and I would listen to both of you as I was running around doing things before heading to WKBD-TV for my my anchoring reporting shift from 2 to 11. So you guys were an essential part of my Saturdays, and now I have you here.
And maybe more importantly, I remember you supporting public radio. So, you know, you come from a good place.
The circle's complete. It's great to have you here. You know, I stop and I think about how you have each devoted your lives to acoustic roots music, folk, blues. And I'm wondering, what makes a song or a melody roots music?
That's a very good question. I think maybe for me, it's the idea of what attracted me to artists like Sonny Terry and Bronnie McGee or Sam Lightning Hopkins or even Son House. I think it's the immediacy of it. You don't have a drummer, you don't have a bass player, you don't have a lot of the, I guess, artifice of pop music. What you have is somebody really with an instrument and the voice coming directly from the heart. And I think I've always been in love with the immediacy of it.
And I would only add to that the idea of tradition, that when you're talking about the kind of music Robert and I play, we're talking about something that stands on the shoulders that goes back not just decades, but thousands of years. You know, a character will pop up in a blues song that you can trace back to a ballad that's 400 years old.
Well, to that point, I went to your website and I was listening to the music you had up there, and you've got a recording of the song Stewball on your website, which is about a horse that raced in England and Ireland in the 1750s, but then to realize it became an American chain gang song that Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie made famous. I mean, talk about the twists and the turns that these songs take. Right.
And then Peter, Paul, and Mary had the biggest version of it, and it doesn't sound anything like any of the other versions. Robert and I refer to it as like playing that game of telephone that kids play, where if you whisper something in one kid's ear and then they whisper it, the fun is at the end, the message is never the same. Well, roots music, what we're talking about, this American folk music, is really like centuries worth of telephone. People never writing this music down, people remembering it the way they're remembering it, passing it on. It gets remembered a different way, and pretty soon you have 17 different versions of an obscure horse race that took place in Ireland in the 1700s.
Or the melody that, for example, the When Johnny Comes Marching Home goes back to Irish folk music. Mm-hmm. And when you think about what that means, total difference if it's being sung on the road to Sweet Athy in Ireland versus the Confederates' marching song.
What it does, though, for us is it tells our story. This music tells our story, and I think that is really probably the biggest appeal, wouldn't you say, Robert?
I definitely agree. The idea is that we want to not only celebrate the product, but we want to celebrate the process. That idea of hearing a song somewhere or hearing a melody somewhere and then using that melody to produce something else, which in turn produces something else, that's a process that I think needs to be celebrated and protected and promoted. And it's very different from the idea of picking the next big artist, American, whatever, because, you know, you have a certain amount of charisma, smile, whatever. But the idea that the song itself is that which is preserved. And by preserving the song, you preserve the feeling and the associations and all of the great grist that goes into making this stuff what it is.
I'm interested in knowing, before you ever wound up on radio, you both had years and years of being working musicians, and I'm wondering, when did you first pick up an instrument?
Actually, I started my performing career after my radio involvement.
But you've been playing, right?
I had been playing for a little while.
Yeah.
And what it was is you know, in every community when I was growing up, there was always music around us. There was the guy down at Hudson's downtown who would sing in the loading dock, the blind busker. To this day, I don't know who he is. But I remember as a kid walking past him and hearing him singing and yelling, whatever that was he was playing. And so my grandmother had a friend named Mr. Buddy who had, as far as I know, one song. It was called, "I'm Going to Kansas City, Honey, Where They Don't Want You." And I remember Mr. Buddy playing that song. And then, you know, I got a hold of a guitar and sort of started to teach myself how to play. For me, that was a really valuable experience. And to have Mr. Buddy come by the house one day and see my little guitar in the corner and say, "You mind if I try your box?" And I go, "Oh, I've arrived, Mr. You know."
So I it's have like, ascended to the heights.
I have ascended to the heights. So it's just that kind of natural idea. And also the idea of being the nerd. You know, not having four brothers who could dance, Motown was not going to happen for me. But being the kid who could take that guitar and it would be your friend and it would be your object of power and all that kind of good stuff, it's really been a blessing.
And you, Matt.
Here's what fascinates me, Cindy, is that Robert and I grew up about 25 minutes apart from each other in completely different worlds. And it was really public radio that brought us together. I was 13, 14 years old at Plymouth Canton High School. And I walked into this classroom of a woman who's passed on. Her name was Barbara Masters. And she had this amazing room. It looked like the DIA had exploded, you know, so there wasn't a single place in the entire room where there wasn't a sculpture or a poem or a picture or a, it was just this beautiful testament to art. And on this little coat hanger sticking in the acoustic ceiling tile was this sign that had three words, and it said, "Art saves lives." And I thought to myself as a 13-year-old, that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. And then,
what can you tell me? I'm 13. I know everything.
And then isn't it funny? I've never forgotten that sign because those three words have really defined my life. Art, in fact, has saved my life as well as countless others. You know, we talk so much about sports in schools and of course, it does great things. But I don't think we tell the story enough about that kid who maybe couldn't put a sentence together but could speak Shakespeare from a stage, or a kid who could not say what was on his mind but could pick up a paintbrush and paint what was on his mind.
Or play it on a piano or on a guitar.
And so at the same time Robert was discovering the blues in the Detroit Public Library, I was in the Dearborn Public Library looking up Bob Dylan and Tom Paxton and Phil Oakes and the Greenwich Village folk scene. And here we were. We didn't know each other yet, mm-hmm. but we were already doing the work that became our friendship and our career.
I love that. So you were down at the main branch of the library.
Absolutely.
I used to do the same thing.
Azalea Hackley Collection.
With the headphones on, every album in the world was there to listen to. We were probably sitting next to each other. Discovering the Clancy Brothers, so that there we are. Like, oh, look at this. You know, I'm wondering over these years that you've been musical partners, because you've got over 30 years of doing this, have you seen audiences change or evolve in the way that they receive these songs? I'm wondering, are they hitting people in 2019 the way that you saw them do them in 1989?
You know, I would say that it's a fascinating thing to watch. As a performer, you're able to sort of see just how much the stuff you're doing is needed at any given time. And it depends. Often it reflects what's going on politically and socially in our country, because it is the people's music and it has always reflected what the people are up to if you're doing it in an honest way. I think it's safe to say that right now it's being received better than it's ever been received in my career.
What's the hunger? Why is the hunger there?
Well, I think because, you know, we live in a fast food society and everything is sort of immediate and packaged for you. And when you sit down to that home-cooked meal, there's nothing like it. And this music is like the home-cooked meal. It has substance. It has power. It tells a story. And I think people hunger for that, especially young people, especially love being exposed to music that is not all about style and flash.
And then isn't marketing to them all the time? And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that this music does for younger people. It isn't asking them to buy anything. And they get a little. And, you know, part of the work I've been doing, too, is this idea of community singing, this thing I really adopted from an interview I did with Pete Seeger when he was 89 years old. This idea of bringing folks who just love to sing, whether they're good at it or not, doesn't even matter. But there's something about creating a human connection through art which creates really strong connections.
And with that in mind, would you play something for us?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure.
Ready? One.
Sowing on the mountain,
sowing on the mountain,
reaping in the valley,
reaping in the valley.
Sowing on the mountain,
sowing on the mountain,
reaping in the valley,
reaping in the valley.
Sowing on the mountain,
sowing on the mountain,
reaping in the valley,
reaping in the valley.
You're gonna reap just what you sow. Been a gambler,
if you've been a gambler,
better quit your gambling.
Quit your gambling.
If you've been a gambler,
if you've been a gambler,
well, you better quit your gambling.
Better quit your gambling.
If you've been a gambler,
if you've been a gambler,
well, you better quit your gambling.
Quit your gambling.
You're gonna reap just what you sow. Sowing on the mountain. Soaring on the mountain,
creeping in the valley,
creeping in the valley.
Soaring on the mountain,
creeping in the valley.
And that is a home-cooked musical meal from Robert Jones and Matt Wetroba. And with that, I want to turn to your latest effort, this nonprofit called Common Chords, and that's musical chords, connecting communities through music and the arts. What is this effort?
Well, Cynthia, we have logged countless miles together. And when we're trying to get from Detroit to wherever it is we're going, we're having these conversations. And we discovered early on, our first gig together was kind of a window into what we would end up doing for the rest of our lives. Somebody invited us to come and play a record store in Grosse Pointe. They put aside the record bins, and we had never played together. And so we're trying to figure out, what do we know in common that we can play? And I had his repertoire of blues, and Matt has his repertoire of folk. And somehow we were just hitting on a rhythm, and it became country. We started playing. We realized, you know, as a kid growing up in Detroit, I actually watched Hee Haw. So we discovered we had country in common. And so the idea is, behind Common Chords, as we travel along, wouldn't it be great to have a nonprofit that focuses on celebrating those things that we share in common instead of fighting about those things that tend to separate us?
One of the metaphors we use in one of our programs called Music That Matters is the idea that music is like a tree. And on this tree are all these different branches, and each branch might be a different kind of American music, a different genre, if you will. There might be a jazz branch and a folk branch and a blues.
Hip-hop,
but isn't it perfect if you go underneath the ground under every living tree and you find what connects those branches? That's why roots music seems to be the perfect way to talk about the connections. You know, Robert and I will do this program for young people, for older people, it doesn't matter. But one of the things we never do is say the word diversity, because we don't have to. They see it every time we perform together.
And I know that you've got programs you've developed. You've got the website up. Now it's commonchords.net. But how do you want this work that you're doing to bring Michiganders together?
Well, one of the things that we're working on right now, and we're really excited about it because we actually have a couple grants in and it looks good. We've made the finals anyway. and we have a program called 20 Minutes Apart, which really focuses on what Matt was talking about a little while ago, that when you really get to know us, Matt and I are really kind of different. I mean, not us, aside from the fact, you know, he's white and I'm black.
Yeah.
Did you know you were white?
No, wow.
Oh. Well.
Anyway, aside from that, city and suburb, you know, I'm in church every Sunday because I pastor a church on the east side of Detroit. Matt, not so much. And, you know, but he grew up in the cathedral of baseball. And you know, we're really different in terms of personality. We lead parallel lives. Our families are pretty much, you know, same age and things like that. But we start to think about, how could we be so different, but nevertheless have a 30-year-plus friendship and nevertheless be able to share a stage and be respectful? And sometimes when Matt and I are on the stage, I can think something and he does it, or he thinks something and I do.
I've never worked with a musician that I had better communication with, nonverbal on stage. Robert, we can glance over and know what to do next.
Musical,
it's
really, ESP.
It's astonishing.
Right.
It really is. So that could come with 26 hours in the car over the weekend.
Because it sure doesn't come with rehearsal. I'll tell you, we rarely rehearse. But the idea is, that's a conversation we think that this state of Michigan needs to have, that you don't have to be identical to be friends. You don't have to necessarily look alike. You don't have to have grown up in the same way in order to be a community. And that idea of community is a word that tends to separate us. We talk about the black community, white community, gay community. But really the idea of community is something that should unite us, right? Because you're you and I'm me, but we're all together in this stew.
And if you believe that at the root, you know, not just of that tree, but of who we are as humans, we're all connected, then all that stuff doesn't matter. That's a level of truth that's a little deeper than who you voted for or what you believe or, you know,
and
what church you go to.
And what better way to experience that than sitting together with other people, not online, not with ear pods in, isolated from everything,
with
but
art,
together,
music, yeah.
Art and music together. Well, I know that you've got the ARC this Friday, May 17th, and Mama's Coffee House at the Birmingham Unitarian Church on May 18th. And you can go to commonchords.net and find out other shows that are scheduled. And I take it you want to get out and get these programs out to as many folks as you can.
Absolutely. And also, we're interested in the idea of working with other musicians and honoring other musicians.
And other artists.
And other artists.
Musicians.
Absolutely. Not just music.
Music and art.
Yes. Music and art. Storytelling, visual art. All of this is just part of this great mix. We're a couple of guys who've been blessed to have, you know, pretty nicely sustained career. We have great representation, Tammy Levitch, artist management, you know. And so he keeps us busy. But there's a point at which you want to give back. You want to start talking about legacy. You want the next generation of artists that you want to be able to champion the art and just talk about what we've been blessed to do. In some real substantive ways.
We'd like to inspire other artists to realize that you can take these incredible gifts that you have and use them for lots of different and get paid for it, too. And, you know, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. We will be at the ARC in Ann Arbor playing for about 400 kids who have been bussed in from all over. And we've done this program 7 or 8 times this year. And it's you know, Cynthia, once you see 400 kids standing up, crossing arms and singing We Shall Overcome in 2019, it's pretty fascinating to be part of that bigger picture. And we'd like to show artists how they can also take their gifts and put them to work in the community.
Robert Jones and Matt Wotroba, years and years of music, and now you're taking it to this new level with this new nonprofit effort, Common Chords, Connecting Communities Through Music and the Arts. Get all the details at commonchords.net, and what a pleasure to have you here on Stateside. Thank you.
It's great to see you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're going to read just what you sow. You're going to read just what you sow.
Much more to come. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time to check in on some of the latest offerings from professional theater companies around the state as we say hello to David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And we start out with a company that you have had a lot of praise for their previous productions, the Detroit Public Theater.
Yes, Cynthia. It's a company that's only 4 years old, but boy, have they come on like gangbusters, both creatively and from a support standpoint. They are doing a play right now. It's an Irish play called The Beauty Queen of Linan. And it's a play by Martin McDonagh, who has established himself as really maybe the leading playwright of his time in Ireland. It's about a mother and her daughter living in rural Ireland. I won't lie. These two women, like in any good Irish play, are miserable.
They are. And I will say, unlike a lot of the times, I've actually seen it, and you're right. They're miserable. they make each other miserable.
I'm glad that you saw it, because yes. I was going to recommend it to you. They have miserable circumstances, poverty. The mother is a nightmare. The daughter is a bit unbalanced. And this is what I call the perfect Irish play. In that while it depicts sorrowful people in sorrowful times, the dialogue and performances are so brilliantly done, I think, that both the characters and the audience find enough humor in the story to keep it walking forward to the climax. McDonagh is really a superb storyteller. The play runs through May 26th.
So it is worth seeing. And if anyone, he has also written for movies. So if you've seen In Bruges or if you've seen Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, that dark humor, that's funny. So you're laughing even as something awful is happening.
And that's the truth of theater and the truth of his writing, because I know from my experiences, even in the lowest, most sorrowful times of my life, death, whatever, real life, there's humor in it. There's humor. And to capture that as a playwright is genius.
I must say, too, A-plus for the dialect coach, Christopher Corporandi, because he did a tremendous job. I thought the accents were very believable.
Yes.
Not an easy thing to pull off.
It's not. I know, doing my own Irish play,
yes,
that it can be difficult.
All right. So that's what's happening with the Detroit Public Theater, and that's at the Black Box at the Max Fisher Center on Woodward. Now we go just a mile or two south to the Detroit Opera House.
Yeah, they are in the midst of their production this week of Grapes of Wrath. This is, of course, based on the Steinbeck classic. This was, I have to say, an exceptional experience for me. I saw it this past weekend. In the first half, I thought that there were some times that dragged just a little bit. But the second I was thinking that or feeling that, something would happen on stage or in the music that just snapped me right back. Mm. And I have to say that there are two turns of the story, for those who remember from reading it, probably in school, that are two of the most gut-wrenching episodes in American literature for me that brought me to tears. And that's an opera at its best. If you don't cry at a tragic opera, they didn't do it right. And I want to call out Catherine Goldner as Ma Jode and Jeffrey Agpalo as Casey, the preacher, especially for their performances, which I thought were really over-the-top wonderful, as well as the local ensemble. Mm-hmm. The MOT ensemble, which they're always good, but in this case, a bit over the top, wonderful in this. And composer Ricky Ian Gordon, who was in the house Saturday, said this week that when he was asked to write it by the Minnesota Opera more than a decade ago, that he actually had never read the book, which I thought was fascinating.
The book floored me, and I thought, this is really scary thing to say yes to, because it is, for one thing, antithetical to my, you know, suburban Long Island upbringing. But also, it's like the world's favorite book.
That amazes me. I thought we all got that book in ninth grade, but you know, wonderful.
That book still, because of schools, I imagine, yeah. I read that it still sells 150,000 copies a year.
It's powerful. All right. And now we are going to the Williamston Theater, see what they're doing.
Yeah, they are opening a world premiere this week called New Releases by one of Michigan's leading lights in the theater, Joe Zettelmeyer. He's a terrific and prolific playwright. The play is set in a small town video rental store. Remember those?
Yeah. Used to be a Friday night. You'd have to head to the rental store.
You know, there's still a couple around. When I go to Pinckney, there's one there. And I just wonder, I don't know who's going there. But anyway, it's a mystery, actually, the play. Zettelmeyer's a terrific storyteller. And it is great to celebrate our local playwrights. So, and the Williamstons, the quality of the plays that they select to do are wonderful. Yeah. So it's exciting. This is a world premiere.
Good
by
to
Michigan
know.
Playwright.
All right, so that's the Williamston Theater, and some they're going to have some fun in Marine City.
Yes. Now for something completely different.
Yes.
The Riverbank Theater in Marine City is in the midst of their production of Nonsense. And Dan Goggin, who I'm pretty sure is a Michigan native, has written all of the Nun plays, you know, Nonsense and Meshuggah Nuns and Nunset Boulevard. And they're really silly, a little bit stupid, but people love them. It is light comedy entertainment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's silly. It's an order of nuns. And a bunch of them die from food poisoning by the cook, and they don't have enough money to bury them all, and they have to have a fundraiser, so they put on a show. I mean, what could be more ridiculous and silly than that?
Sisters in Habits, singing and dancing, right?
Right. And they opened it already, and it'll run through, I believe, the end of this month.
Okay.
So
time to make it to
a few more weekends to see it.
Indeed. And for anyone who wanted to see Hamilton when it was at the Fisher in March and April and couldn't get in, you got another chance.
Yes, it is at the Wharton, and very similar to the Fisher, there is a lottery that's mm-hmm. sort of ongoing. So if you don't have tickets in your hot little hands yet, there's still an opportunity, and you can go to Encore today to sort of get an update on the whole lottery system.
Yeah, and they do. And actually, you get the Hamilton app, and you can do it on your phone. I know it's opening May 14th and running till June 2nd at the Wharton Center. And this is the same cast, the Angelica Company, who played in Detroit. But if none of that works out, guess what? You can start 2020 in West Michigan with Hamilton, and the other touring company, the Philip Tour, will be in Grand Rapids.
In Grand Rapids.
At the beginning of next year.
And I reviewed this, and I believe you saw it too. It's
great.
Really just as wonderful as the Broadway or the Chicago experience.
The juggernaut rolls on indeed. All right, David Kiley. As always, you can get details on these and other productions by going to EncoreMichigan.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Where it happened, the room where it happened, no one
one really knows how the game is played. The art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens.
When Michigan voters approved Proposal 1 last November, they were saying, yes, we are ready for marijuana to be legal, which raises a big question. What do we do about the roughly 50,000 people in this state who've been convicted of marijuana crimes? Advocates are working hard to get those convictions cleared in our state, and it's a process that has begun in California after pot became legal there. So let's talk about how it's playing out as we say hello to Scott Rodd. He's the state government reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Hey, Scott.
Hey.
Good to have you with us. So Proposition 64 was the law that legalized pot in your state. It was passed in 2016. What kind of language was in that law regarding these pot-related convictions?
So in Prop 64, it included language that allowed folks who were arrested and convicted on charges related to cannabis to petition the courts to have those convictions reviewed and potentially expunged, either cleared or reduced. And it didn't go into very much depth in terms of what that process looked like, but the language of the proposition said that folks with those convictions could petition the courts.
Okay, so it opened the door, but it kind of didn't say how it was going to happen.
Exactly. It was left up to essentially lawmakers. Once voters approved Proposition 64, lawmakers in California took that proposition and figured out, okay, how are we going to codify this? And there were a lot of moving parts to it. The clearance of convictions was just one relatively minor aspect in a much bigger effort to legalize cannabis in California.
So who took up that issue? Was there anyone who took point on advocating for people with these pot convictions?
You know, it's been mostly cannabis industry groups and then also legal reform groups or groups that represent folks with past convictions. Lawmakers included this language in the law about petitioning to have the courts clear or reduce these convictions. But what the state ended up discovering is that just because it's in a subsection of a law doesn't mean that suddenly everyone who it applies to knows about it. So a lot of the advocacy came from groups trying to get the word out saying, hey, you know, if you have this conviction on your record, you can go and petition and get it potentially cleared or reduced. That fell very much on the shoulders of criminal justice reform groups for the most part.
When you stop and you think about the reason for doing this, there's certainly this issue of racial inequality with that studies have found people of color are way more likely to be arrested and convicted for marijuana offenses, even though whites, Latinos, and blacks use and sell pot at pretty similar rates. How are these old convictions kind of hanging around and dragging people's lives down?
You know, it has a pretty significant impact on people's lives, probably much more than most folks would realize. There's the obvious things like, having a criminal record, if that comes up in, say, a background check, obviously, if you've spent any time in jail or prison, that can be a pretty significant disruption in someone's life. But there are also things such as being able to access certain government benefits, being able to secure certain licenses and certificates to later on in life, move into certain areas or move into certain careers. All of those things, many of those things, I should say, are blocked or it's much more difficult to do if you have a conviction like this on your record. So the impact is pretty far-reaching. It's not simply just having a blemish on your criminal record. It has a pretty significant impact beyond that.
And certainly, even if you wanted to get in the pot industry, it would be an issue.
Yeah, that's been something that the state of California has been wrestling with. The big word in California has been equity. And, you know, this goes beyond simply addressing criminal convictions for cannabis, but also figuring out ways for people who have had past convictions or have lived in areas that were over-policed during the war on drugs, figuring out ways to help them get into this now newly legalized cannabis industry. So that's been a big push, and that word equity has been kind of on the tongues of many people in California.
So when Prop 64 was passed, were authorities and prosecutors kind of expecting a flood of appeals from people who wanted those old convictions expunged?
I think definitely the state was expecting that a lot of people would step forward and say, hey, I have one of these convictions. I'd love to have it cleared or reduced. But what they found was essentially crickets. very few people stepped forward. And again, it came down to awareness that this was an option. But also petitioning the courts is a fairly complicated, fairly time-consuming process. So this is something that even for folks who knew about it, actually getting it done turned out to be a pretty tough lift. So for example, in San Francisco in 2018, I believe it was about 23 people petitioned the courts to have their convictions cleared or reduced, which I mean is far, far lower than the number of people who would be eligible to have this. So the expectation was that, yeah, that there would be a flood, but it turned out that that wasn't the case.
So are there certain areas, certain cities that have kind of gotten out ahead of the curve in getting these cleared?
Yes. And so the state actually has taken a position that they want to proactively address this issue. Last year, there was a law that was passed, signed by Governor Brown, that requires the State Department of Justice to identify people who may be eligible for clearance or reduction and to send those convictions to county prosecutors by this summer. And it was estimated that there would be about 220,000 plus convictions that would be identified for potential clearance. However, a number of cities and counties have gotten out ahead of that and said, you know, we actually want to be proactive about this. We certainly will accept those recommendations from the state when they come, but we're not going to wait for the state to issue those. And so cities and counties like Sacramento most recently, and then San Francisco, Los Angeles, have reviewed convictions in their databases and found cumulatively tens of thousands of convictions that will be reduced or cleared.
California is now using an algorithm to search through all these thousands of pot-related crimes. How's that working?
It appears to be working well. So the technology side is through a partnership with an organization called Code for America. It's an organization that works with local governments to identify civic issues and then address those issues through technology. So Code for America came in and said, hey, we're interested in helping out county prosecutors who are interested to review their conviction databases to see, you know, which convictions may be eligible. You know, instead of having some rookie on the squad look at convictions one by one, we can get an algorithm that looks at this very quickly and makes your life for county prosecutors much easier. So right now, it's in a pilot form. It's a handful of cities. As I mentioned, Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Fran are all part of that. And there are several others as well. But Code for America has said that they're interested in expanding that pilot program. And it looks like it's been successful so far.
And just so we're all clear, are there some convictions that would not be eligible for expungement, for being wiped away or reduced, or you know, is it pretty much all pot related convictions?
So there are some caveats there. For example, if the State Department of Justice sends over a big batch of convictions to a county prosecutor has an opportunity to review those and challenge some of them if they think the individual would pose a risk to public safety or if clearing it in some way would be unjust. So there is an opportunity for county prosecutors to speak up and say, no, we don't think this is quite right, or this would do more harm than good. So there are some caveats there where county prosecutors can challenge the clearance or reduction.
So California is a little further down the road of pot legalization than Michigan. What can Michigan learn from California, Scott?
Well, I think Michigan is in a good position. You know, I think it's always good to have some states sort of blaze that trail ahead of you. I certainly know that California was looking at Colorado and Oregon for legalization in terms of learning lessons from those states. So I think several lessons that Michigan can learn from California is that just because something goes into law, such as the opportunity to clear a conviction, it doesn't mean that it'll automatically happen. Again, just because a certain subsection of a law says that you can get a conviction cleared or reduced, it doesn't mean that suddenly everyone knows about it. And even if they do know about it, they may not know how to go about it, and they may not know what the process is or how much is involved. So I think putting a law in the books is one thing, but ensuring that there's clarity to that, that there is clear communication about that, and that there's support along the way for folks who do want to take advantage of the opportunity to clear their past convictions, that they have those resources there, whether they be legal resources or other resources to help them along the way. I think that's a big lesson that California has learned and Michigan can probably take away from California's experience.
Scott Rodd is the state government reporter for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll talk about where the movement to clear pot-related convictions stands here in Michigan. And if you're interested in this topic and want to continue the conversation, you can join Joshua Johnson, host of 1A This Week in Detroit. He'll be hosting a community conversation this Thursday, May 16th at the Wright Museum. Doors open at 6:30. Get all the details at Michigan Radio's Facebook page. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Bella Isaacs, Sarah Leeson, Adam Reyes, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.